This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, a small town at the center of a big controversy over whether or not to house the state's first privately operated detention facility for undocumented immigrants. We'll also tell you about a group that won't see the same bump in pay from the state's new minimum wage law. We've all heard about the dwindling bee population, but some researchers have a new approach to measure the impact.
So if all of these beekeepers, as they go through their hives, collected information for us and then sent it to us or uploaded it to this database, it would allow us to see not just a local snapshot of what's going on in Champaign-Urbana or in Chicago, but actually get to see what is going on across the state.
Also, a story about Illinois school districts and just how long students are required to be in class each day, and a fight that pits academic freedom and free speech on college campuses. That and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Ahead, our series on affordable housing continues. We'll also look at one segment of workers in Illinois who won't fully benefit from the higher minimum wage, and a controversy over free speech on college campuses. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. Getting us started this week, spring has returned to Illinois. With it comes April showers, May flowers, and of course the bees that help those flowers grow. In recent years, though, bee populations have been dwindling for largely unexplained reasons, and if the trend is not reversed, supply chains across the country could suffer shortages of food from apples to avocados. But one graduate student at the U of I Urbana-Champaign is out to stop that by arming beekeepers and concerned citizens alike with data. Our reporter Sam Dunklaw sat down with the entomology student Jacob Torres to talk about his work assembling a beehive database.
Jake, let's dive right in. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're trying to do with this bee database?
Yeah, so in general, the Dolezal Bee Research Lab, we focus on trying to understand landscape-level predictors of what exactly affects honeybee health, which means that we like to ask questions like what practices work in certain places that might not work in others, and what beekeeping features are associated with better bees. However, honeybee health is a very complicated topic to tackle or problem to tackle because it's not just one factor that impacts it directly. It's actually a lot of different factors, including pathogens, pesticides, the microbes in their guts. So being able to understand how these interactions impact honeybee health is extremely complicated and requires a huge number of hives to collect data from to be able to accurately understand.
In the last several years, we've been hearing a lot of news about things like collapsing hive syndrome. All of a sudden, there's all these bees, and then all of a sudden, there's not. Did the impetus for this come from any of that, or can you talk a little bit about the origins of all of this?
Yeah, so over the past couple of years, like you mentioned, there's been a lot of stories that talk about this decline in bee populations across the country and also across the world. So it's a little bit different. There are native bee populations and there are honeybees, and both populations are seeing a decline. With Bombus affinis, which is the rusty-patched bumblebee, that was listed here in the United States as an endangered species, and that was the first bee to be listed on there. So this has been happening due to several different reasons, which aren't completely clear yet. And the reason why they aren't clear is because there are, again, all of these factors that are in interaction with one another, whether that is virus loads, which is one of the hypotheses that a lot of scientists think is responsible for the decline in bumblebees, or also pests and mites. There are these little mites that are somewhat like ticks, but they're bee-sized. They're called varroa mites, and these varroa mites have also been a large reason why honeybee populations have been in decline recently.
You've talked to some landowners around UIUC about the health of bees and making sure that apiaries around their area are healthy. What are some of the other Illinois-specific problems with bee health that you're noticing in your research?
So right now, there's actually this pest that new to Illinois beekeepers. It's called small hive beetle, and it is a pest that has been creeping up from the south, and due to climate, it hasn't been able to spread all the way to the northern region of Illinois. However, every year we have been seeing that it spreads a little bit more. And this hive beetle takes over the honeybee hive and will start eating their resources, but also it'll start laying larvae throughout the comb. When these eggs hatch into larvae, they produce something that's very slimy. And so a lot of beekeepers have been reporting that their hives have been slimed out, meaning that there are so many larvae there, so much slime produced, that it pretty much kills their hive and doesn't allow them to be productive or pollinate the plants around them.
So in talking about those sorts of problems, how do you and your team propose that a bee database can, you know, sort of start to address some of those things?
Yeah, so we are really excited about this new project that we're starting. And this is in collaboration with Penn State and Purdue, where we have made this new website, and it'll eventually be an app. It can be accessed at beescape.org. What this project does is it creates this website where you can see a map pretty much like you would see like on Google Maps through a satellite. And it uses several different layers so we can start to understand how the landscape is around a certain apiary. So you can click on a specific location. Let's say you have beehives at your house. You click on your location or you type in your address, and it'll give you scores based on the probability that they'll be exposed to pesticide, the probability that they have good quality forage throughout the summer, but also spring and fall, and also the amount of nesting habitat for native bees. Because native bees many times don't live in colonies, but are actually solitary and nest in twigs, sticks, in the ground, or in holes. So by clicking on your apiary, you'll be able to see how these different landscape variables score in your area, and then be able to better predict where you might be able to place a hive to reduce the amount of pesticide that it is exposed to, or to increase the amount of forage that is available for your bees. And the idea is that over time, by informing beekeepers of where to place their hives, we can get better, healthier, more productive hives. But part of this project is also asking the beekeeper to collect information for us as well, where most beekeepers open up their beehive at least once a month to check out how their bees are doing, make sure that the queen is healthy and laying. So if all of these beekeepers, as they go through their hives, collected information for us and then sent it to us or uploaded it to this database, it would allow us to see not just a local snapshot of what's going on in Champaign-Urbana or in Chicago, but actually get to see what is going on across the state and let us see these landscape patterns to better understand honeybee health and be able to produce these better, healthier hives.
Sure, yeah. I imagine all that would be incredibly helpful and useful for all sorts of groups. How has local hive outreach been going? Have beekeepers been willing to jump on board with this?
Beekeeper reaction has been extremely positive so far, which is really exciting. So I have been going around the state presenting to beekeeper associations, and at the end of my presentation, I have asked them to raise their hand if they were interested in participating, and it's usually at least 75% of the audience members have raised their hand and said that they are willing to participate. Afterwards, I've gotten many emails from people in those presentations thanking me for giving them the presentation, but also expressing how excited they are for someone to be doing a project like this, and the ways that they are already thinking that it might benefit them. So overall reaction has been really, really positive, and I'm just excited to get as many beekeepers to help us out so that we can get as large of a database as we can.
So after this database has been established, what are the next steps? How will all this data be used?
All of this information will be used to inform other beekeepers of what practices work in certain areas and what practices don't work in their areas. However, this may also lead to actual policy change. In this project where we are using citizen scientists, but also in this other pollinator project, is to tap into that wealth of knowledge that is out there from people who are actually doing the work every single day. They know so much. It's just not described in scientific literature, and that's what we're trying to gap But the scientific literature can then be used to make these recommendations, not just to the individual beekeeper, but also regionally and in policy as well.
All right. Jake, thanks so much for talking to me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Sam. I really appreciate it.
That's entomologist Jacob Torres talking about his work assembling an Illinois bee database. He talked with our reporter, Sam Dunklaw. You can find out more details by going to our website at statewideshow.com. A reminder, we're on Facebook. You can like us there and also follow along and keep up to date on what's going on with Statewide. Look for us on Facebook. Two of the biggest universities in the Chicago area are grappling with the limits of free speech on campuses. The debates are playing out as President Donald Trump recently weighed in on the issue. He says he wants to withhold federal funding for schools that violate free speech rights. Universities say that's a bad idea and that they should handle this situation themselves. But as Kate McGee reports, many students are not satisfied with how universities are responding.
It was a sunny, frigid February afternoon on Northwestern University's campus, a cold day to hold a protest. But it didn't stop the couple dozen students from marching, their breath visible as they chanted. The students want Northwestern to remove a visiting scholar from campus. His name is Satoshi Kanazawa, a professor from the London School of Economics. He's published scientifically debunked papers with titles like Why Are Black Women Less Attractive Than Other Women? And Are All Women Essentially Prostitutes?
We are here today to demonstrate that we won't stand for this. We are here today to teach and to learn together, and we are here today to demand equitable and transformative change.
More on that story in a bit. Just last week, the University of Chicago had its own free speech debate bubble up. Students there spoke out against a white law professor after he used the N-word in class. It's something the professor has done for years, using the word as an example in a lesson. The University of Chicago said faculty can choose what ideas to express in the classroom and how to express them. At Northwestern, administrators gave a similar argument, academic freedom. Kanazawa's ideas are protected, even if they're considered hateful. John Holloway is Northwestern University's provost.
Protection doesn't mean that we sit by and accept them, but that if we disagree with them, that we mount an academic case of why those ideas are bad. That's what a university should be doing.
Holloway says Kanazawa wasn't vetted enough by the psychology department, but he isn't teaching or conducting research. And now that he's on campus, Holloway argues removing him would set a dangerous precedent. If he removes a professor whose ideas he disagrees with, what's to stop the next provost from doing the same thing?
And that's too much authority to invest in one person. Students don't quite understand that aspect of it.
But many of today's students, especially more progressive ones, aren't buying the academic freedom principle that many universities hold dear. That includes University of Chicago law student Amiri Lampley.
There's no issue with the law school embracing the spirit of the freedom to speak, but I don't think it should come at the expense of a group of people's dignity.
Lampley is president of the University of Chicago's Black Law Students Association.
You cannot purport diversity and inclusion and then fail to foster an environment where students from all backgrounds and demographics can learn without feeling isolated or targeted.
Students at Northwestern feel the same way. Alina Berry is a graduate student who attended the protest last month.
Somebody is purporting scientific racism in 2019, and we're all just going to say, it's unfortunate, but it's academic freedom. It's definitely a tired argument.
Kolonji Nzinga, a postdoctoral researcher at Northwestern, says students there are trying to redefine what academic freedom means.
One that is inclusive to many cultural groups, many ethnic groups.
At the University of Chicago, the Black Law Student Association said it would not participate in the school's Admitted Students Week in April, a protest to the university's response to the professor's use of the N-word. They see this as a symptom of a larger cultural issue on campus and urged the law school to reconsider the free speech policy. But that's unlikely. The University of Chicago prides itself on its unequivocal support of free speech on campus. Professor Jeffrey Stone is a well-known proponent of free campus speech.
The idea for Chicago from the beginning has been that this is an institution that is committed to the totally free and open pursuit of knowledge and debate and broader understanding.
A few years ago, the school sent a letter to freshmen saying the school didn't support trigger warnings that alerted students of sensitive content or safe spaces where certain issues couldn't be discussed. Stone supports that point of view and disagrees with students who want limits to academic freedom. But that doesn't mean those students can't have an effect on him. Remember the teacher who used the N-word in class? That was Jeffrey Stone. Stone says after speaking with the students about using that word, he had a change of heart.
Listening to these students persuaded me that, at least at this point in time in history, that using the word is more detrimental than beneficial.
Stone says his conversation with students was a great example of how free speech should work. They presented their argument, he was persuaded, and changed his mind without being censored. But he says that doesn't mean he'll stop using the word in all contexts. That's another reason the Black Law Student Association is withdrawing from the university's Admitted Student Weekend. When issues like this crop up, Amiri Lampley at the University of Chicago says it usually falls to students of color to explain why and how certain speech can be harmful, an extra burden.
We're like trying to like write petitions and figure out what our next steps are while also preparing for like three exams and writing two papers, which speaks to the bigger issue. But I think, you know, if not us, then who?
And this situation is just one of the many battles she has to fight to create a campus where all students feel comfortable.
As a minority, the freedom to speak freely will never protect us the way it has our white counterparts. We actually have something to lose, whether that's a seat at the table in corporate America or a perpetual reputation as emotional and angry. We, unlike Professor Stone and others, will not receive accolades for our free exchange of ideas.
She says that's one thing academic freedom doesn't take into account, on or off campus. Kate McGee, WBEZ News.
Just ahead, the role that tips play in some salaries, and is it time to change the rules? We'll have a report ahead on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. Ahead, we'll continue our series on affordable housing in Illinois. We'll also hear about a push to increase rural broadband service. That and more still to come. Governor J.B. Pritzker recently signed into law an increase in the state's minimum wage, but restaurant servers, bartenders, and others who depend on tips say it's not a full victory. Our Illinois Issues report this week comes from reporter Daisy Contreras.
Ramika Atan of Chicago worked in the restaurant industry for many years. She says she put up with a lot while working in a burger restaurant.
I was forced to wear a tight pink shirt that had 1-800 call juicy on it, and the comments just rang in. You know, every time I came to a table, they really treated me like I was on the menu, like I was an option for them, for their source of entertainment and whatever they felt like.
She says she would sometimes confront customers with rude comments, but she knows not all restaurant workers do, for fear of losing out on the tips that make up the bulk of their pay. Atan and many others who work in the state's bars and restaurants want to end the dependence on tips.
This is the only job where we are putting the bill on the public, where we're forcing the public to pay something that the employer is supposed to be paying.
Illinois employers can pay tipped workers just $4.95 per hour, and have tips make up the difference to reach the minimum wage. That's called the tip credit. On slow days when tips are not enough, employers are expected to put in the rest. Under Pritzker's minimum wage law, that base wage for tipped workers would rise to $11 an hour over the next 6 years. But some say that any tip system still puts workers in vulnerable positions, open to harassment and wage theft, and should be axed altogether.
Unfortunately, Illinois did not do that in its recent minimum wage deal.
That's Sadeh Gebrselassie with the National Employment Law Project in New York.
Which is a shame, because what we've seen in states that do require employers to pay the full minimum wage is that these workers have lower rates of poverty, they're able to better provide for their families, and importantly, the restaurant industry has been able to adjust.
Those who took part in negotiations say it was all a part of a compromise to get the Illinois Restaurant Association on board with a minimum wage increase. The group declined multiple requests for an interview, but said the tip credit offers flexibility and serves as an incentive for good customer service. State Representative Will Gazzardi, a Chicago Democrat, told tip workers in February he understands why they might feel left out of the plan.
We know that our fight's not done, and I share your belief that that system is unjust and it's unfair to workers, and you have my solemn commitment to stand with you in working on addressing the injustice of that system in the years going forward.
While some business owners are pushing against the change, fearing a hit to their bottom line, other employers are taking a different approach. Mark Voronesh, owner of Cafe Moxo in Springfield, has been paying his employees a $15 minimum wage for several years now. Tips are always separate.
We didn't want our employees to have to totally depend on tips. The tips is what we consider is, you know what, that's going with your service above and beyond.
Still, Voronesh says he wouldn't support eliminating the tip credit.
So we're certainly opposed to it, because I think it does help the business owners, and you do need, regardless of whether what wage you're paying, you do need that advantage, I think, moving forward.
Those who oppose eliminating the tip credit point to the state of Maine, where the credit had to be reinstated after removing it because servers in restaurants complained customers were no longer paying tips. So there were no cash bonuses. Seven other states, including California, have already eliminated a tip credit system. Different studies show varying results of the change, some pointing to restaurants closing, while others show the industry growing. Now, Congress is also considering a $15 minimum wage increase, and in that same proposal, phasing out the tip credit. Ramika Atan of Chicago has left the restaurant industry and is now advocating for the one fair wage without tip credits. She says she's optimistic, especially after Pritzker signed the minimum wage increase into law.
It definitely is a step, but there's too many people that it excludes for us to really, really fully call it a victory.
I'm Daisy Contreras.
You can read more of our Illinois Issues story for this week. It's available at our website, statewideshow.com. Slow internet service can slow a business down, adding up to lost time and money. And often, the problem is worse in rural areas. And that's one reason the acting director of the Illinois Department of Agriculture says improving internet access is a top priority for him. Mary Hansen talked with John Sullivan about why he wants money for broadband in a state infrastructure plan.
There are a lot of pressing issues facing farmers in Illinois, you know, the trade wars, environmental concerns. But recently you said rural broadband is a top priority for you. Why is that?
I know firsthand how the lack of adequate internet access can affect both an individual, but even more importantly, a business. So my family is in the auction business. A lot of auctions are online anymore, and certainly you need the bandwidth to handle an internet bidding program. And so when our business was looking and expanding that, we really had poor access to the internet. We didn't have adequate high-speed access to the internet. So it's really a hamper. It drags a business down. It holds them back. There's so many businesses that can be operated from their home or, you know, obviously from a business location. And if there isn't adequate access to high-speed internet, it really drags and holds back, you know, the possibility for jobs and opportunities in those areas. And we've seen that certainly in the rural parts of the state is where the access is most limited. So I really think that the access to broadband and high-speed internet is dragging and holding back the rural parts of the state.
The Department of Agriculture has a vast number of responsibilities, from conservation programs to protecting the health of livestock to overseeing the state fairs. What can the Agriculture Department actually do to improve internet access?
Well, I was the co-chair of the governor's Ag Transition Committee. That transition committee, we spent a great deal of time of talking about some of the needs out in the rural parts of the state. And access to broadband internet service came up in almost every conversation that we had. And hopefully, not if, but when the General Assembly and the governor's office sit down to talk about an infrastructure or a capital bill, that we can provide to them the support that is needed and the evidence that there is a tremendous need for broadband, and especially in the rural parts of the state. To have our voice heard in those discussions, I think, will hopefully we'll provide the support that's needed to make sure that the funding is there.
There's some federal funding, but it sounds like you guys are looking for state funding. What's kind of the order of magnitude? Are we talking millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars?
Well, I don't know. So I would only be speculating and guessing, but certainly tens of millions, if not 100 million. You know, I don't know what that number is. I know it's a big number because there's vast areas of the state that need their internet service upgraded. And so when I met with the folks from the USDA, they were very much interested in partnering with the state in the event that there is a capital bill. We could work with them.
Are there particular areas of the state that you want to focus on where there's little to no access?
You know, I haven't seen a map of the state as far as access or lack thereof. Just in, you know, my conversations with individuals, especially on the Ag Transition team, we had folks from all over the state. This was on everybody's radar. So Northern Illinois, Southern Illinois, East and West, it seemed to be a problem in all parts of the state.
That's the acting director of the Illinois Department of Agriculture talking with our Mary Hansen. And you're listening to Statewide. Most Midwestern states license and regulate midwives who are specially trained to handle out-of-hospital births. Illinois is not one of them. Advocates say that's created a problem for mothers who want a home birth. Carrie Vickery is vice president of the Illinois Friends of Midwives, which is an advocacy group. She spoke with Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman about why she considers the home birth situation in Illinois a maternity care crisis.
We have a lot of women families who are interested in having a home birth for a lot of different reasons, personal reasons, religious reasons, philosophical reasons. And because the state has chosen not to license or otherwise legalize trained home birth providers, a lot of these women don't have a provider at all. And so what that means is that they go looking for a provider, they can't find one, and some of them will choose to just have a birth at home without any attendant. So when you have birth attendants and you can't verify their training, then that puts mothers and babies at risk for a bad outcome, or it puts them at risk for not having the best resource they could at home to keep their home birth safe.
Because as it is, there are home birth midwives who work in Illinois, but you're saying licensing them would help that system to be regulated so that it wouldn't be essentially an underground market?
Correct. And what we have now is an underground market.
The committee that would be formed with this joint resolution that the Senate just passed would provide the General Assembly with a consumer-focused, evidence-based solution to the home birth issue here. Why do you see this as an important first step toward your end goal of having Illinois license home birth midwives?
Various groups have been working on licensure for more than 40 years. What I've seen personally, what I have gathered from talking with the people who've come before me, is that there are various groups, but usually the medical societies, who persistently choose not to work with us on language that would hopefully come to a bill that would be acceptable to them, acceptable to consumers. And so the hope is that this resolution would bring together the different parties who feel that they have an interest in home births and in mothers, and kind of force them to come up with language or actually to discuss what the real heart of the issue is.
Do you have a personal interest in this issue as well? Have you had a home birth yourself?
Well, all three of my births were planned with home birth midwives. My first birth actually was a transfer from home, non-emergent, to the hospital, and everybody was fine. And we did that under the suggestion and guidance of our midwives.
What would you say to someone who says, why don't these women just have their babies in the hospital? Because sometimes we hear it described as, well, home birth would be safer if midwives were licensed. But then we have the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Their position is the safest place for a baby to be born is in a hospital. What's your response to that?
Well, there are always going to be families who choose for their own personal religious reasons, their philosophical beliefs. Sometimes it could be trauma related, to not go back to a hospital. And here in Illinois, nurse midwives are licensed as nurses to be able to attend home births. I think there are a couple of nurse midwives, like literally a couple, it's like three maybe in central Illinois, but their ability to attend is pretty limited by their whatever their licensing rules are. So that means that, you know, women still don't have access to midwives just because there aren't enough nurse midwives who are able to attend home births. So when you have a group of people who you know will not choose to go to the hospital, I think it's far safer to make sure that they have licensed providers than it is to just say, well, you shouldn't do that, and we're not going to give you any access to any kind of a trained provider.
That's Carrie Vickery with Illinois Friends of Midwives, speaking with SideEffects Public Media's Christine Herman. When it comes to addressing homelessness in Illinois, one issue stands out. For many working families, housing just isn't affordable. Steph Whiteside with Illinois Newsroom talked with one family, and she has this report.
The Stevens family first became homeless when their landlord refused to make repairs to their home.
Our roof was a joke. Our roof had a big old huge hole in it, gaping hole. And when it snowed, we had snow in our kitchen.
Jenny Stevens, her husband James, and their two daughters were living in a small town in central Illinois. The family relied on the money James brought in working in the fast food industry for minimum wage. James would need to work 99 hours a week to afford a two-bedroom apartment in Illinois, based on research done by the National Low Income Housing Coalition. The town they were living in didn't have a code enforcement office, so Jenny called DCFS for help. The agency sent them to a shelter.
And I'm like, well, why'd I call you guys if this is your only option? Because I could have done this on my own. I didn't want to become homeless.
To make matters worse, the shelter the Stevens were staying in was nearly an hour away from James' job.
Every little ounce of his money was going in the tank.
Camille Doris, executive director of the Southern Illinois Coalition for the Homeless, says this situation isn't unusual.
If, say, for instance, you're making minimum wage or something close to minimum wage and you're trying to afford a two or three bedroom home, eventually the bottom is going to fall out.
And we still don't know the full scope of the homelessness problem.
What we find is a lot of times people will not go to a shelter. You know, they will choose to stay in their vehicle, in a tent, couch hop, whatever they need to do to keep their jobs.
That creates problems because HUD, which funds public housing programs, doesn't consider someone couch hopping or crashing with friends to be homeless. For Doris, whose agency relies heavily on HUD funding, that means they can't help a lot of the people who need it.
We have about 700 people that walk through our doors on a yearly basis that we cannot house. We don't have a place for them. We don't have the type of program that they need.
The Stevens qualified for a Section 8 housing voucher, but having a voucher doesn't mean there's a unit available.
We were starting to look, but I mean, people that take HUD vouchers is kind of hard to find, even though they give you a list and stuff. But sometimes they say, well, I've got too many people right now that's using HUD vouchers and I don't have anything right now.
There are only 35 affordable housing units for every 100 Illinois families considered extremely low income. That's based on numbers from Housing Action Illinois.
People oftentimes wait and wait and wait, and they try to find a place that they can move into, someone that'll accept a Section 8 voucher, and they can't. And then sometimes they just flat out cannot find a landlord that will accept it.
The Stevens did eventually find help, moving to Southern Illinois and getting transitional housing from the coalition.
Right now, we have a great landlord and all that, and they come in and fix things.
Like many Illinoisans, the Stevens will benefit from legislation raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. But data from Housing Action Illinois shows that, on average, you'd need to make over $20 an hour to afford a market-rate apartment. Bob Palmer is their policy director.
For some people, it means that they'll no longer have a cost burden and that they'll be able to pay, you know, 30% or less of their income to afford housing, and that's a good thing. Other people, you know, the increase in minimum wage is not going to be enough to ensure that they have affordable rental housing.
The wage increase will phase in over 6 years, and Palmer says housing costs are expected to continue rising over that time. Camille Doris, whose agency is tasked with housing people in the meantime, worries that current policies don't do enough.
Sometimes I think we put a Band-Aid on that problem and say, oh, problem solved, you know, for now. But we see those same people coming back through after a certain amount of time because they've not been able to be successful. They've been basically set up for failure.
I'm Steph Whiteside, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a public media collaboration covering education, politics, health, and the environment. I'm Sean Crawford. We're glad you're with us for another episode of Statewide, and there is more on the way. An Illinois town sees opportunity in housing undocumented immigrants, but there are opponents to the idea, and that story is still to come on Statewide. We're back on Statewide, and still ahead, an Illinois town and the controversy there over a plan that could bring a detention facility for undocumented immigrants. We'll have that story. Up next, Macon County officials got a chance to plead their case this week for a piece of Governor J.B. Pritzker's promised infrastructure plan. But lawmakers had something to ask of them in return. Mary Hansen explains.
After listening to stories of crumbling roads and bridges, Democratic State Senator Martin Sandoval asked the Decatur mayor and the county board chair, would they support a 25-cent hike in gas taxes to pay for the repairs? And would they lobby their representatives to do the same? Decatur Mayor Julie Moore Wolf said yes, with a caveat.
I just need to make sure that there is not perhaps a guarantee, but a good formula that allows for sharing, and we know that our portion of that money will come back here.
She's a Democrat, though her office is technically nonpartisan. Macon County Board Chair Kevin Greenfield, a Republican, says he would be okay with raising the gas tax too. That's the kind of bipartisan support that a big infrastructure plan will likely need. Illinois' current gas tax is the same as it's been since 1990, 19 cents a gallon. I'm Mary Hansen.
Negotiations on an infrastructure plan are expected to continue over the next couple of months. More than a year ago, Illinois lawmakers approved a total overhaul of the way the state funds its K-12 schools. That got a lot of media attention, but at the same time, something else happened that went totally unreported. The state changed the number of instructional hours required in a school day from 5 all the way down to 0. Our education reporter Dusty Rhodes has the story behind how that happened, where it all stands now.
Let's be clear, the new law didn't force any changes, so most districts carried on with their usual schedules. And as soon as the teachers' unions noticed the 5-hour requirement had been dropped, they began to lobby to reinstate it. But by that time, a few districts had embraced the new flexibility and didn't want to give it up. That left the State Board of Education caught in the middle. I sat down with Amanda Elliott, the board's director of legislative affairs, to learn more.
The school code used to require 5 hours of instruction per day. That requirement was sunset in the evidence-based funding law and then repealed in a subsequent trailer bill.
So it disappeared when we passed school funding reform?
Well, in the trailer bill. So it was no longer a requirement after funding reform.
There have been questions about how did that happen? Like, how do we go from 5 clock hours required to 0 clock hours required and apparently nobody noticed? Was that just an oopsie? What happened?
Evidence-based funding was a large piece of legislation negotiated over several years, and the section that authorized school funding included the 5 clock hours. So when we changed the formula, that requirement was removed from the school code.
So it was a long, arduous process, and the formula changed multiple times.
There were several iterations of the bill that were filed over several years.
In one of the later changes, switched from funding based on average daily attendance to funding based on enrollment, right? And so that kind of explains why average daily attendance, the clock hours, slipped out?
Well, we still collect average daily attendance for some other calculations, but the clock hours specifically were included in the same section as the previous funding authorization.
So when people noticed that clock hours had disappeared, some superintendents liked that. I mean, at first blush, it could sound crazy. You aren't required to be at school. So what were schools doing instead?
We found that many districts were primarily using flexibility this winter for e-learning days for students.
E-learning means doing their homework online when it snows.
Yes. We heard from districts that they saw this as an opportunity to allow more use of dual credit classes, internships, career-based learning experiences. And so there's a lot of excitement about what this could mean for schools and students in Illinois.
But now there's legislation that's going to restore the clock hours. So I remember at the table was a representative from the state's largest teachers union and a representative from some of the most well-financed school districts that would be able to take advantage of all this flexibility. Where did we end up?
The amendment reinstates the 5 clock hour requirement and allows for exemptions from those hours in 4 key areas for students who are enrolled in dual credit, those participating in career development experiences, those participating in apprenticeships, and those participating in blended learning programs. It also expands the e-learning pilot from just 3 districts to any district statewide.
All right, so it kind of resets the clock.
Clever.
Except that now everybody can do e-learning.
Yes, the amendment was adopted by the Senate Education Committee and still needs to be reviewed by the full Senate and the House before it goes on to the governor for signature.
I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Amid dozens of new lawmakers at the State House, a few fresh faces are beginning to stand out. Jacqueline Driscoll has more on a rookie state representative who's planting her flag as an advocate in the area of mental health.
Karina Villa is a 40-year-old Democrat representing West Chicago. She's one of 7 lawmakers in the House of Representatives whose election flipped a red seat blue from Republican to Democrat.
I said I'm done complaining and I'm going to go out and try to be part of the solution instead.
She was a school social worker for 15 years and says that's actually why she ran for the state legislature.
I saw under the last administration how mental health services in general were dwindling. It was a lot harder to access services for my students. Families that I worked with were in a middle class community in DuPage County, were really struggling with just meeting basic needs.
Social service agencies, including mental health services, are still licking their wounds after they were decimated by a nearly 3-year-long budget stalemate between former Republican Governor Bruce Rauner and Democratic lawmakers. But Villa says this is a unique time for mental health in the state and across the country that could inspire some real change.
Now, the brilliant thing about being here in Springfield at this time is that people want to talk about it. It's a bipartisan issue on both sides of the aisle. People are now willing to look for solutions and to put resources behind this problem.
And she plans to use that momentum. Villa's first piece of legislation, introduced early last month, would require schools to specifically discuss mental health within the health curriculum for all students. The idea is to help kids recognize the signs of things like depression or anxiety. When presenting the proposal to lawmakers, Villa shared a story about a 5th-grade student who she had concerns about for years. It wasn't until an in-class assignment where students read a Time magazine article about mental health that he made an important discovery.
That student had to be excused from the class and came to see me, and he was in tears. And he looked at me and he said, "Miss Villa, I finally know what's wrong with me. I have depression. I need you to call my parents, and I need you to tell them that this is what I have."
And that's what Villa says she wants to see happen more often. 1 in 5 children have or will have a serious mental illness, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness. She wants to help children recognize the signs. Those who are opposed to the legislation don't necessarily have a problem with the idea of it.
The way that her bill is written are more goals for what the mental health curriculum is doing, and we think that would be better placed in the Illinois Learning Standards.
That's Zach Messersmith with the Illinois Statewide School Management Alliance. He says adding it to the state standards rather than a curriculum change could prevent it from being another unfunded mandate, requiring schools to have new textbooks, for example. The measure has failed to generate any Republican co-sponsors. It did pass out of the Mental Health Committee unanimously, where lawmakers on both sides of the aisle applauded the freshman lawmaker.
Representative, thank you for bringing this bill forward. Congratulations on your first bill.
Rather than hazing you, I'm going to praise you. I think this is a great bill.
Representative Villa, I just wanted to first say congratulations on an outstanding first bill.
With a vote of 19 yeses, no noes, this bill, House Bill HB 205, will favorably be reported to the House floor. Congratulations, Representative.
I'm Jacqueline Driscoll.
listening to Statewide. A small town in Livingston County could become home to the state's first privately operated detention facility to house undocumented immigrants. But immigrant rights groups are vowing to fight it. Michael Puente has that story.
There's a water tower, train depot, a few shops, but not much else in Dwight, Illinois. But the historic Route 66 passes through here, so according to some locals, you'll run into the occasional British tourist stepping in.
Dwight's a friendly town. It's quaint. We all know, everybody knows everybody. We can walk on downtown and not worry or have a threat.
That's Dallas, who's sipping on a beer and playing video poker with friends at a downtown Dwight tavern. Dallas declined to give her last name. She says Dwight used to be known for the Dwight Correctional Center. For more than 80 years, the DCC was a prison for women, even housing those on death row. Dallas used to work there but lost her job when the state of Illinois closed it in 2013 to help shore up the state's sagging budget. But residents say it hurt the town's economy in the process.
When it closed, sure. It was a big institute for years here in Dwight.
Dallas's friend Doreen Hobson says the town has struggled ever since.
We've already had our shop closing up. Now we hear dollar stores closing up, Family Dollars. I don't know. Definitely needs jobs, but I don't know what sacrifice.
Hobson worries that means sacrificing Dwight's peace and quiet. But some have other reasons for opposing a facility to house undocumented immigrants. This protest happened prior to a Dwight Village board meeting where officials approved annexing nearly 90 acres of land to build a detention center. It's slated to be built by a private firm, Virginia-based Immigration Centers of America, for use by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
We believe that if this proposal moves on forward, they will build a 1,200-bed detention center, making it the largest immigrant prison in the Midwest. And more than anything, that would ramp up raids in our communities.
That's immigrant rights activist Gabriela Marquez Benitez of Chicago. A native of Mexico, Benitez herself was once an undocumented immigrant with her father housed in a private detention center. Benitez has followed the 7-year struggle for ICE to find a location to build such a detention center in the Chicago area.
This has been a whack-a-mole game throughout Illinois and Indiana of private prison companies trying to come and build a detention center here.
These are people who do not belong in detention.
Fred Sow is policy director with the Chicago-based Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights.
These are people who are being torn from the communities with no criminal history. There have been 7 other communities that have considered for-profit detention centers prior to Dwight. All of them have been defeated.
But what makes this effort different, the village board, led by Mayor Jared Anderson, wants the facility.
You know, we're familiar with the aspects of having a facility that's very similar to this here. So I think that puts us in benefit of some other places and having a better understanding of what they are.
This village board meeting was moved to the Dwight High School Gymnasium to accommodate all the attendees. While there were loud opponents, there were some supporters like Dwight resident Bart Scott. Wearing a red MAGA hat, Scott says if the firm LSC Communications, a commercial printing company, closes, there won't be much left.
If we lose LSC, we lose our school. If we have nothing to fall back on, I'm asking that you have this detention center and not be intimidated and threatened by these protesters who have absolutely no vested interest in Dwight.
The board's vote to approve the detention center drew jeers, but the process isn't over. Mayor Anderson says there are locations in Wisconsin that are also being considered. If he's counting on help from the state to lure ICE, he can forget it. Governor J.B. Pritzker doesn't support it. In a statement, Pritzker says he opposes President Trump's anti-immigrant agenda. And Pritzker says he will work with advocates to ensure Illinois remains a welcoming state for immigrants. But if ICE selects Dwight, protesters promise to return. We'll be back!
We'll be back! That's Michael Puente with that report from Dwight. And that does it for another week. Thanks for tuning in to Statewide. Join us right here next time. If you missed any of this show, or if you want to find past episodes, head to our website, statewideshow.com. You can also find an email address and drop us a line. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.